Tuesday, August 15th, I was hopelessly awake by 7:15. These six-hour nights are not long enough for me. Lyndon went in and got Baby and put him on the bed between us. And as he read his innumerable papers, talked on the phone and read those reports, Lynn boxed the air with his little fist and eyed both of us curiously. He's getting to use his feet a lot more. He kicks. He's quite an armful to hold. I had a good talk with Lucy. We could hardly stop and kept Doug Cato waiting several minutes for his appointment at 10:30. He wanted to present to me an idea of a program which I would sponsor to get books into the hands of underprivileged children on a nationwide basis. Anna Hoffman would be the chief activist in it. It sounds very good and also like a full-time job. Margie McNamara's program here in Washington would be used as a sort of a prototype. I agreed to do it, and then Doug pulled from his file with a rather portentous air, saying, "I'm sad to have to show you this, a telegram from Paul Horgan," a vigorous expression of his dissent from the United States policy in Vietnam. To him, it was the only humane attitude, and to me, it's only naive. It makes me sad when it is someone I know and like. I went over to Lyndon's office, and at 11:30, we went out on the grounds for the welcoming ceremony for the Chancellor and Mrs. Kiesinger. The roadway was lined with people who began to cheer as we walked by, lightly. I looked into their faces and wondered how many of them belonged to the 39% that Sunday's poll said favored us, and how many to the 61% of those who didn't. But that is the time for a smile and a calm face. I looked, too, for the two youngsters from Jefferson, Mary Lou Davis Ford's son and the little hall boy, and for some of our house guests with which the house was bulging. And then the big black car rolled up, and out stepped Jimmy Symington, smooth as silk, and the very large and imposing figure of Chancellor Kiesinger, who was as tall as Lyndon and as broad of shoulder. A very imposing man. Mrs. Kiesinger was sweet-faced, very black hair, no English, soft and pleasant manner. As I gave her the bouquet of red roses, I vowed to myself for the dozenth time that I must tell them not to put the asparagus fern with them. It sticks to your dress like a green plague. We're having a canopy now in the summer's heat. The first summer I can remember it. And very welcome it's been some of the time, but today is delightfully cool. There seemed an unusually heavy contingent of press. The German visit carries a lot of interest. Trumpets and flags and 19-gun salute and the stern-faced erect military. It was a magnificent setting. Mrs. Kiesinger murmured her admiration of it. The Chancellor seemed relaxed and very much in command as he made his speech. A very impressive man. And then we were inside in the diplomatic reception room, murmuring "Your Excellency" to everyone that went by, and the Dean bowing over my hand. And then as I greeted Walter Tobriner, I wondered whom I would be introducing next time as the Mayor of Washington. Back upstairs, I worked at my desk, but in a desultory manner. Sometime during the morning, I had met Joe in the hall, and he had said goodbye. First of our wonderful house full of children to go. A break in the fullness of the household. What a good time it's been. I had lunch on a tray, and then went back down to the diplomatic reception room to say hello to some people from Marshall, the Nesbitts. Their twin sons, Vance and Lance. Some friends of Diana's. And the Kupp Krugers and their daughter and the American Field Service student, Bibi, who's staying with them from Argentina. Everybody had a camera eagerly poised, and so I suggested the steps by the wisteria vine. And group after group, we posed, and I signed autographs. And just then, the Herr Jerzigs drove up. They, too, were our house guests. And I gathered them up and escorted them to their room on the third floor. It's always such a warm and pleasant feeling to be able to make people from back home, like the Nesbitts, feel good. Mr. Nesbitt had known Tommy, and he'd known Daddy. He had traded with them, as he put it. Back upstairs, I had lunch on a tray and was joined by Linda and Roy Lynn. I felt curiously depleted, in fact, depressed, a word I loathe and do not like to permit myself to use. But I must face it, I was depressed. And so I clung to the talk with Linda and after she left with Rory, who told me about her beau. She's trying to make up her mind whether or not she's in love and how seriously. and a job as teacher of second grade. And then I turned out the light and tried to go to sleep. And from 3 o'clock until 6, did nothing, which is close to sinful. I was too dull and weary to work and too tense to sleep, and so I wasted 3 good hours of my life. It was 6 o'clock when I got up and went over to Lyndon's office, and together we saw the slides that Look had made of Lyndon and the baby and the dogs, and I was in a few. There were some great pictures. Back on the second floor, I took a new grip on life, phoned my 2 remaining house guests, Archbishop Lucy and Mayor Harry Aiken, to welcome them. Went in to see Lynn, had a comb out with Miss Jean, who was as nervous as I am about it, John Louise on vacation, and dressed in the lovely flowing green chiffon by Stravopoulos, reviewed the guest list for the last time, and then began that tightrope 10 minutes when Lyndon rushes in from his office much too late, gets into his evening clothes quicker than I could believe possible. We hold the elevator. I act as liaison with Bess, she with Blair House, and then, like the curtain going up on the stage, just as everybody behind it gets into that position, we're downstairs and out on the north portico, calm and serene. I hope it looks that way as the big black car with the flapping flags drives up. Once more, I am impressed by what a large man the Chancellor is. It's rather an asset for a chief of state. That must be some element of de Gaulle's success. And right behind the Kiesingers is their attractive daughter and their husband, Kurt Wenzel, whom we had met on our Scandinavian trip, photographer for National Geographic. And the vice chancellor, Willy Brandt, whom I had always thought so attractive from his pictures in Lyndon's conversation when Lyndon had been to Berlin in August of 61. There were 3 other members of the German party, and Dean and Virginia and Hubert were already upstairs awaiting us in the yellow room. It was a warm pleasure to see George McGee beaming and describing how Cecile and 7 children were living in the villa in Florence overlooking the city, the most divine place, he said. Linda came in, and there were happy reminiscences of her time with them in Germany, and then Pat and Lucy. I had had a strange little pang as I watched Lucy dress, a white evening gown with a blue stole that she had worn frequently last summer. In fact, I think perhaps the first night she had met Pat. And she had looked at me rather anxiously and said, "How do I look?" And I knew that no one in all the world liked dresses more than Lucy. And so I put a charge of enthusiasm into my voice when I told her I thought she looked great. It was so becoming, knowing all the while that she was a little sad that she didn't, like Linda and I and many of the other women present, have a lovely new dress for the occasion. But her black hair was piled up high, and she was stunning. And Lynn came in and was shown around everybody, making a great hit and behaving beautifully. This time, one of our gifts, I took great pleasure in describing, though the describing was really only for the other guests. For the Kiesingers knew at once and beamed with pleasure. It was a National Geographic map case, with the cover a picture by their son-in-law, Kurt Wenzel, of a scene dear to the Chancellor, the valley of the Danube, where he was born. And he began at once to tell us all about it, just as happily as Lyndon would, if in some far land a chief of state had presented him something very personal and related to the hill country. And the gifts were really an exchange of maps. Theirs to us was a very handsome copy of an old map dated 1507, found in a castle close to his home, on which the word America was used for the first time. This was only 15 years after Columbus had discovered it. And it appeared on the far western edge of the map as just a long, attenuated island with appropriately no western boundary. It just melted off into the sea. Kiesinger made a joke about this land should have been called Columbia after Columbus, but because it was made by a university professor, he gave it the name of a fellow member of academia, a minor navigator of the day named Amerigo Vespucci. On what slim threads does history hang? I found the Chancellor spoke quite good English, although he used German for his public speeches, so I chattered away to him as we descended the grand staircase about the house, its uses, its changes with the years. I was determined to make it a great evening for the Germans, for all our guests, simply for the satisfaction of knowing it was a well-done party. I wanted to rise in combat against my lethargy and depression of the afternoon and pay life back simply for the gift of life. It's hard to explain, but troubles arouse one's fighting spirit. My eyes rested on Chuck Robb, handsome in his Marine's uniform, very stiff and erect, with as close to a wink as I could get at a state dinner, and then we were in line between the flags and the great cross-section of our government and country that make up a state dinner. Were filing past. First the German party, and then from the cabinet besides Dean and Virginia, Bob McNamara without Margie, she still must rest a lot, and the handsome young Secretary of Commerce, and then from the Senate, Margaret Chase Smith, all serene dignity, with the single rose that is her trademark, and the young and attractive Scoop Jacksons, Mike and Maureen Mansfield, and husky-voiced George Murphy of California. Somehow the aura of an actor still clings around him. But two of my favorite governors, the young and attractive Curtises from Maine. And later, when our first course was lobster, I waved down the table at them and said none would ever be as good as the lobster steaming under seaweed that we'd had on the rocky coast of Maine. And the warm and intelligent Hewlett Smiths of West Virginia, such a congenial part of my trip through Appalachia. There was a sizable contingent from the House. We're having more from the House these days. Among them, two of the women members, Mrs. Frances Bolton and Mrs. Edith Green, and my old friend of the campaign trail, Basil Whiten of North Carolina, and his wife. And that tough veteran, Mike Kerwin, who had brought his daughter in place of his wife. And among old government hands, the Dean Atchisons and the Walter Hillers. I heard such a delightful story about Dean Atchison the other night. At a dinner party, he had been listening to Stu Symington, whose opinions on Vietnam were wild, vehement, and unclouded by any doubt. Dean Atchison said, "Stu, this just goes to prove that I was right about you several years ago, and I was for you for president. Because if you were president, you would never dare utter such nonsense as you have just said." In the entertainment world, there was the actor Lee Marvin, and composer of Music Man Meredith Willson, and big, impressive Raymond Burr, whom I at once felt was a personal friend, and I almost introduced him as Perry Mason. During the evening, I noticed he always had a crowd of admirers around him. There was Democratic committeewoman Millie Jeffrey, and the Gene Wymans from California, and that indefatigable advance man, Marty Underwood. I had the Chancellor on my right for dinner, and Willy Brandt on my left. The Chancellor proved a very interesting companion. My usual opening gambit, "Have you been in politics all your life, Mr. Chancellor?" brought the offbeat response that he had begun by thinking he would be a poet. He'd actually published 2 books of poetry in his youth, and then he had thought of going into politics. But in his words, 1933 ended that. How do you ask a German today, especially a powerful German, what he did between 1933 and 45? That takes a combination of tact and incisiveness, which I have not mastered. The Chancellor skipped over it, and then he said, "After the war, we went back home. It was all bummed out. There was not," he said, "a chair or a table, nothing left. I spent the next year trying to keep my family alive. Going into the woods with an axe, cutting firewood, there was no coal, and looking for mushrooms, doing anything to keep my wife and 2 children fed and warm. And then after a year, I got a job in the university as a professor, and things were better." And here he clutched his arms across his chest and shivered and said, "The classrooms were freezing. There was no coal to burn, and all the windows were bombed out. We wrapped up in all the sweaters and coats we could get. But there was an excitement, a pride, almost a pleasure as he talked in remembering those years. To meet the ultimate chance of survival and to spend every last ounce of muscle and brain you've got must be a very special sort of intoxication for a man and a nation." And it made interesting listening. Billy Brandt was not so easy to talk to. In fact, I was disappointed. I had expected too much. I asked him how many trips he had made to this country, and he answered, "I think 13. One of them, he told me, was back when Senator Lyndon Johnson arranged a trip for him that took him through Fredericksburg, where a luncheon was given for him. He had been to the museum there, had become acquainted with the German heritage of my part of the state. We talked of Lyndon's visit to Berlin in 61 and the lovely China I cherish, but I missed any feeling of rapport, of real interest in the evening on his part. Not so the Kiesingers. They seemed to be having a marvelous time, and especially the Chancellor's daughter, attractive young Mrs. Wenzel, on Lyndon's left, whose youth and liveliness I was grateful for. Hugo Black was back in circulation for the first time after his second eye operation, and the years are at long last laying their withering hands on him, in body, if not in spirit. We had coffee in the red room and the green room afterward, and a few minutes for visiting, and I had a sort of a New England reunion with the delightful Bill Youngmans and Governor and Mrs. Curtis, and then into the East Room to hear the National Gallery Orchestra. Give a program that was half the music George Washington might have listened to. A march, a minuet, the Brandywine Quickstep, in which the refrain of Yankee Doodle was just below the surface. And then the last half, Mozart. It was a rather scholarly, sedate program of entertainment. The other side of the spectrum from Hello, Dolly. But patterned after the entertainment, German princelings would have enjoyed in their courts in years gone by. We really run the gamut here, from grand opera to Navajo fire dances, the chamber music to guys and dolls. After the pictures with the entertainers, Lyndon took the chancellor's arm and we went out into the hall where champagne was being passed. And I knew it would be a night of still two more hours' work for Lyndon, with night reading, and so I was not sorry when the chancellor and Mrs. Kiesinger made their way to the front portico. Lyndon left almost immediately afterward, but I lingered to have as many visits as possible. The Roy McDermott's, she's Raymond Buck's daughter, and our invitation to Raymond had come back with a sad response. He was ill. He was afraid he could not come now or later, but he would like it so much if sometime we could invite his daughter Kay and her husband. And so, of course, we did right away, and I was delighted that she had so much fun. They were a very attractive couple, and among the first to take to dancing, as was Lucy with our house guest Harry Aiken, a very gay and vigorous dance. I had asked her to take care of him, and I noticed her through the evening, being very attentive, as she was Archbishop Lucy of San Antonio. The Kulp Krugers were very much at home with everybody, and handsome Harry Jerzyk had a few words of German with the Chancellor. I whisked Dr. Harrar off into the blue room for a few quiet moments on Daniel Webster's sofa to tell Dr. Harrar about the plans for the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Service, what we hoped for it, what its potentialities were, how much we needed a really great director. He said he would think about it and would get back to me with some possible names, and would, of course, talk to Dr. Ransom. He pleased me no end by remembering that I had been to Chapingo in Mexico City and said how much it meant to them to have that recognition of the place and that much bringing it before the public's eye. And I was delighted that I could remember one concrete example there, two pictures of loaves of bread, one small and shrunken that they had grown from the wheat of the region for centuries, and another large and abundant, grown from a new strain of wheat that had been developed by that technical research. To me, it was the most exciting moment of the evening. And I had a nice moment with Walter Heller, letting him know that he was appreciated by this administration and by the Johnsons personally. A pleasant moment with the diminutive Samuel Newhouses, and then a really happy time with the starry-eyed youngsters from Jefferson, Mary Lou Davis Ford's son, and the little hall boy. They're leaving to return to Texas tomorrow, and I am even happier than they that they got to come tonight. I wouldn't be surprised if they mentioned it a few times when they get back to Jefferson. It was nearly 12:30 when I went upstairs and gathered up the Krugers and Harry Aiken to have a nightcap with me. Lyndon was long since at his work, and we had a happy little reminiscence of my trip through Central Texas where I believe it was at the fish fry where I'd encountered Culp. His loyalty, his fondness for Lyndon is as strong as ever, but he conveyed to me the depth of the disturbance, the bitterness of many white people, himself included, against the niggers, and I am sure a great deal of it will come to a point against one man, the president. His was the feeling of the second generation American. His parents had come over, dirt poor, as he said, from Germany, and his wife's parents from Poland, I believe, and they had had to work and sweat their way up the ladder. And as he expressed it, we don't like to see it handed to them on a silver sleeve. I was reassured to hear the mayor take a quiet tone and not just ride off on a wave of emotion. He said that for the first time, Austin, as a biracial mediation board, I gather any citizen can bring a complaint to it about discrimination in public facilities, the police, and so forth. He takes his job as mayor very earnestly. Once more, it was after 1 when we went to bed.